Thank you. How was your lunch? And how was your lunch discussion? Uh-huh. Was it that good, huh? Were we talking about the movie we saw last week, or... Right? So one commercial advertisement again, if you're interested, if you weren't here last night, there's a retreat I'm leading on the Lam Rim in about 70 minutes train ride outside of New York. There's a flyer outside hosted by our center in New York, Shantideva Meditation Center. What I was just talking with somebody here at lunch, that we get a lot of Lam Rim teachings. This is our fundamental philosophy, but then we don't actually meditate on it. So that's what makes your mind change, is to meditate on the teachings. And so this will also teach people how to meditate in an analytical way on the teachings. And I find it's some of my favorite things to lead. So I really encourage, if you have a time and you want to spend some time in upstate New York and make a little trip, it's beautiful up there. And the center, it's a Garrison Institute, so you can think about that. Thank you. So how is the nature of your mind? Any interesting comments from lunch or anything like that? Any insights, questions? Yes.
I noticed that I have a sense of expansion in my mind, that I was much more open to receiving what other people had to say and of participating. That's pretty unusual for me.
But it's nice, just a little bit, from a little bit of conversations with people at lunch, that briefly, but some people, like you, what you just said, having that little sense of being able to observe the mind, the observe whatever it's doing, but just watching the mind instead of getting so engaged with what you're doing, thinking, or saying, right? So that's very powerful. It's very powerful. And then you need a little rejoicing at that. You know, just for yourself, like, hey, I kind of watch myself. I watched myself grasping onto the prayer wheel for sale in the bookstore, right? Yeah. Somebody was, where is she? Anyway, somebody else, we were just joking. But, so that's very, thank you, that's very powerful.
I have a question about your clear sky. The clouds come, but where does delusion remains? Do they really exist all the time, and then it comes?
Yes. So they don't. They. It's a good question of where does a delusion actually exist? And basically, great question. Due to karma, and karma is literally action. That's what it means. It's a Sanskrit word. It means action. It's the movement of mind. So every time your mind moves, and what I mean, it could be thought, it could be speech, it could be an activity of the body, it leaves an imprint in your consciousness, in the mind, in your consciousness. It makes an imprint like planting a seed. And then the positive seeds we have there will ripen in happiness for us, and the negative seeds will ripen in suffering for us. A lot of you have heard karma teachings before. I don't need to go into it, you know, specifically. But so the delusion is one of these seeds that gets planted. So it's not really the nature of the mind. And how the seeds are in there in relation to the mind, honestly, I don't know. I don't know how that works, that system. Karma is extremely intricate. And they say you need a highly realized mind to really understand the workings of karma. So we can understand the characteristics of karma. We can understand the 10 virtues and the 10 non-virtues, you know, how to conduct ourselves. Buddhism has its own 10 commandments, in a sense, which are practical, related to body, speech, and mind. I can understand, like, a little bit of a ripening result and things, but how the imprint gets actually made and then how it stays in there to create additional, let's say, if it's a negative imprint, an additional pattern of that negative imprint. And I give you an example. The way we can trace it, And this is where I'd go back. So I can't answer that question specifically. I don't know. But what I would say is, and let me explain a little bit more about the mind right now. The mind exists on three levels. So there's gross, subtle, and most subtle. Gross, subtle, and most subtle. Okay? I love that, right? And the train's been very generous, hasn't it? It hasn't been very noisy. I saw one time I came to teach here, and I just felt like every time we try to meditate, it's like, you know, I'm like, it's been very quiet, this thing. So maybe it's not the train, maybe it's my mind. Oh my God, what a concept, right? I just saw an old friend here at lunch. We were talking, so he's known me for many years when I ran another center in California prior to Milarepa Center. And then he said to me, wow, you look great. What, you know, and I'm like, because I'm not running Milarepa Center anymore, you know, because he said the last time I came I was really in it, and I was really pretty stressed, and so maybe that's why I thought the train was too loud. I don't think it is right now. So you see how interesting? You change in here, and externally, seriously, it changes out there. So let me just go back to gross, subtle, and most subtle, the mind. And also, the body is moved by winds that exist on a gross level, a subtle level, and a most subtle level. There's a gross wind, subtle wind, and most subtle. And they interrelate, the body and the mind, but they are separate. Okay? For instance, I'll give you a gross wind. You can hear it, you see it, kind of rising. We're all familiar with that basic respiration. Okay? Subtle wind, well, we're not in contact with subtle winds. However, there's upward moving subtle winds in my body moving now that allow me to speak, to chew food, to swallow, to cry, to blink my eyes, to turn my head. Upward moving subtle winds. Downward voiding subtle winds allow you to walk, sit down, eliminate waste from the body, have an orgasm like that. Downward voiding subtle winds. Okay? And then the life force, the most subtle wind. I talked about that a little bit last night. Most subtle wind. Okay? Now the mind, gross, subtle, and most subtle as well. Gross moments of mind or consciousness, I'm going to talk about. Gross moments of mind, we can trace. So just bear with me for a minute. You're standing at this doorway in the back where most of you came in the room. Okay. What happens is you're standing at the doorway, whether it's your first time or your fifth time here, but what happens is there's sense consciousness taking in the room. So visual eye consciousness takes in the data of the room. Look around the room, okay? These are moments of mind that have you interacting visually first with the room, and then there's actually a decision-making process of where I will sit. These are gross moments of mind. My mind actually actively makes a decision there, and then there's gross moments of mind, so that was a gross moment there, deciding, and then there's gross moments of mind that are the result of that decision that then put my body in a certain position to move to that seat. Okay, and putting my body in a certain position to move to that seat is dictated by gross moments of mind, and that causes the next moment for me to begin to maneuver my body in a certain way, and that gross moment of mind causes the next moment and the next moment and the next moment to get me into a position in front of the chair, turns me around a certain way, and then that causes me to sit down. Everybody following me right now? And this is in the mind course, so gross moments of mind. How many of you have done the mind and its potential? Okay, it's a pretty good number. Okay? So you're familiar with some of this, right? I can always hear it again and again, but okay. So we can trace that a little bit, the gross moments of mind. Okay. Subtle moments of mind, too subtle. Sometimes maybe in long retreat, your mind gets into a more subtle space. You might be able to notice, and I'm talking about subtle fluctuations of the consciousness. So they say in a finger snap, there's 64 or 65 fluctuations of the consciousness. In this, 64, 65 movements of your mind. Very subtle. Right? You're not going to catch that. There's the mind moving, moving, moving. Then the most subtle mind is its clear, this clear light nature, spacious luminosity. Okay. How to describe it, I don't know. I don't know that experience other than it's been described to me as the most luminous light you can imagine, beyond even words like that. Clear light nature of mind, its most subtle state. Okay? And that residing, basically, the most subtle wind residing in the center of the heart chakra, energy center at the heart center, not the organ, the heart, but in a subtle energy system, and then the mind attached to that, riding along for a while in that life form until the most subtle wind dissolves and the mind leaves the body, the consciousness leaves the body, forced to find another rebirth as ordinary beings, catapulted into an in-between state called a bardo, which means in-between, transitional state, until you find the next karmic setup that you've created for the next rebirth. Okay, is everybody with me? Everybody following me? Okay, this is what Tibetan Buddhism says. You don't have to believe this. However, because not everybody believes in reincarnation, because it's hard to prove, isn't it? So I will say to some of you that don't believe in reincarnation, what is the proof then that reincarnation does not exist?
Yeah.
There's also no proof for that, right? But an interesting meditation, we're not going to do today, but the continuity of mind, which is again part of the mind course, the continuity of mind. And what you would do is I could ask you right now to trace back from when you sat down in your seat and got in the door. So you could track that. And you could notice, what I'd like you to notice from this is the continuity. So you'd notice that, oh yeah, putting myself in that position was the cause of me sitting down. So what actually caused me to get into that position to sit down was the moment preceding it where I was in that position. And what caused that was the position that got me to that space. And the cause of that was that I got here. And the cause of that was I moved my foot like that. And the cause of that, you see what I'm saying? You can see this connection. So what most of us go back to, you could trace this all the way back in your life. These moments of continuity of your mind stream, the continuum of your consciousness. And the Tibetan system says the mind is a continuum of mental events, activities, ideas, like that, and there's no beginning and there's no end to it. So linear thinking people, like most of our culture, has trouble with that. Because we like to have a beginning and we like an end, and there's a practical reason we have that. So this class started at 10 o'clock this morning. It ends at 3:30, you know, or thereabouts. So we, you know, January is the beginning of the year. Monday can be the beginning of the week for some people. This is when it ends. So we like that. We function in those kind of parameters. And practically we have to, often. So we like to go back to there's a beginning of the mind. Okay. So for some of you, whether you're familiar or not, where is the beginning? Anybody have some ideas? If you didn't do the mind course as well, where do you think the beginning of your mind is?
When you were born?
Okay, when you were born. This is quite a common understanding. When I was born, my mind started. What about when you were inside your mother? No mind there?
No mind?
No mind? Mind is there. Some people think no mind? Okay, the mind might be there because the fetus, if you come out in one moment, and some people are premature. See, so we can kind of analyze. And in Buddhism, we ask you to analyze. We're constantly poking. You can ask Geshe at his studies at Sarah. A lot of debate and a lot of diving into something, you know, cooking it, basically. So you could say, what if the baby has no mind when it's in there, but then it's born premature, it only comes out when it's born at 9 months, but what if it's premature at 7 months? I have friends that developed at 7 months, human beings just like us. So then you go, well, no, there must be a mind then in there. Okay, fair enough. And then some people also say, and I did a lot of thinking about reincarnation because I didn't believe in the beginning in reincarnation. This is my own delving in. Okay? So then people say, well, I don't believe in reincarnation because I don't remember any of my past lives. So they must not have happened. I have no memory of them. Right? So do any of you remember being inside your mother? Right? A few people remember, but not usually. Did that not happen? Well, this is how I chipped away at it. I went, well, that's true. I don't remember that. But there's proof that that happened. There's photos of her. My father said, you know. So that must have happened. So let's say we go all the way back. Most people get back to conception. That's the beginning of my mind. Okay? So conception is absolutely the beginning of your body. Conception is the beginning of your body. And we know biologically when a sperm and egg come together and fertilization takes place of that egg, the cells start to replicate. Well, a sperm and egg are physical. Okay? And your body's physical. Physical things create physical things, not non-physical things. Okay? So that's definitely the beginning of your body. You have two physical things, create a fertilized egg, cells replicate, and that gets you this. How does the mind get in there? So Tibetan Buddhism says it's attached to that most subtle wind at the time, and it has a way that it mounts it like a rider on a horse and is able to stay with it through that lifetime. Okay? So they're attached, but they're separate and they're different, mind and body. But that most subtle mind can come there, can be there with that most subtle wind at the time of that creation of that particular being, conception. Okay, so we'd say, well, that's the beginning then. Okay, but however, all these other moments you can trace of your consciousness has a preceding cause. I just took you through the little thing of getting to your seat from the doorway. That's short. Okay, but if you go back, you'll start to see that, and it's a more subtle meditation, you'll start to see that I realize there's a cause for every moment. Every moment, there's a preceding cause. A moment doesn't just pop in randomly. You can always trace back and see that there was something that preceded it that caused it. Okay? And then I'll even say that what resulted from the cause, we'll call a result. And there will always be a subsequent result. There's no end to it. There'll always be, because that end is the cause of the next moment. That end is the cause of the next moment. This is what Tibetan Buddhism says. That's why the mind goes on. So if you want to go back to conception for a moment, and you've managed to think that all of these other moments have preceding cause, what about the moment of conception? Possibility of a preceding cause to that moment of mind? Just something to think about. Okay, because that would indicate a past life. And the fact that there is a subsequent result, and every moment is the cause of the next moment, and the next moment the mind is without beginning or end, and that means you will go on to something else. Your mind will go on. Body, no. Because it's physical. Its nature is that it deteriorates and it ages. But your mind will go on. Okay? So what we're trying to do here is countering negative emotions, take care of our minds, and improve a little bit more each time we go on so that the future life is going to be something sustainable and something brilliant that'll continue to have me evolve to full enlightenment. That's what we try. That's what we're going to do. Okay? And it doesn't have to be Buddhist. You can do it in another tradition. I don't know exactly if it's similar to enlightenment, but and I always encourage people to stay with their own traditions if they have something that works for them. But sometimes in Buddhism you might find something that enhances that for you. A few additional techniques. So is everybody with me about understanding the beginningless and endless nature of the mind? Yes?
But only humans have minds?
No, in Tibetan Buddhism they say everything has a mind down to a single cell organism. There's some debate about this, but basically everything would have a mind or be sentient, is another word they use. You've heard of sentient or sentient beings, and that would go down to a single cell organism, would be considered to have mind. So they say plants, no. Bacteria, no. Viruses, no. Trees, mountains, streams do not have mind. This is from the Buddha. The Buddha, being omniscient, saw this and said, this is what constitutes having a mind. The proof of it and why, I don't know. I honestly don't know. This is from the teaching of the Buddha. Okay. But I guess that's it, because plants do react to things and respond to things, but is there consciousness there? And again, it can be debatable, but that's what they would say. It would go down to like an amoeba or something, single cell organism. And you can take rebirth in different forms as well. You don't have to come back as a human like that. So that's another class about lower realms of existence, higher realms of existence. All I want to mention to you is, as humans, it's the optimum rebirth for getting enlightened. You have a balance of suffering and leisure in your world. The suffering motivates you to practice. To first want to bring about an end to your own suffering, and then if you get on the Mahayana path, which is Tibetan Buddhism, you get inspired to want to end your own suffering, but so that you can continue to progress along a path to reach a place where you can help others to end their suffering, where you're unlimited as a Buddha. let's see, what was the other thing I was going to say about that? Yes, so basically that would be on the Mahayana path, and I just lost that thought. Let me think. So, yeah, so basically you could move along like that and in other lives and other forms. The human form, because you also have leisure, you have an ability to come here. You have an ability to study with Geshe-la, to take teachings, to do retreats, to get your own practice together. You have that ability. We're not living in a hovel. I've seen in India is women carrying bricks on their head all day long. They don't have that luxury. That's not a precious human rebirth. Okay, there's certain conditions, 18 conditions that make up a precious human rebirth, and we have most of them here. So this is it. You got the perfect situation right now. So I do stress that again and again. I know I get kind of excited about it because I was at a teaching with His Holiness the Dalai Lama in the last few years in India, and His Holiness Ling Rinpoche was there, and he's going to be a great teacher for us in the future, or even now. He's about 30 years old. He speaks perfect English. He's a monk. He's an amazing being. Actually, I was going to say, I just got this last year from him, His Holiness Ling Rinpoche. Okay, there he is. Sorry, it's too small, but he's an amazing being. So I was at a teaching when His Holiness the Dalai Lama said that in his lifetime, His Holiness Ling Rinpoche, so let's say, this was a few years ago, 60 years. Let's say the next 60 years, if he lives into his 80s, right? He said it will become very, very hard to practice Dharma. Okay, so just look at the distractions in your life right now. I've talked to a number of my friends that were around Dharma, say, 30 years ago. And some of the centers, the activities we were doing in California in the 90s and even before that and things like that. And a lot of people were coming. Here it's great because you got a lot of people. But a lot of older students were coming and a lot of higher initiations and different things. And one of my friends, and I was saying something about California where you've got that great program, and she says, no, that's not happening anymore. You don't see many of the older students anymore. You know, and so it's really up to us to keep this going. And that's why it's so precious that you're here, and I really appreciate it. So it's something to think about. This is delectable, but you have to make effort, and it's not easy. So can you look at, I want to just mention a little thing about priorities. We talked about this morning a little bit. Time management, okay? Priorities. This is really about possibly reestablishing new priorities or just adjusting slightly your current system because you have the time. The time is there. It's just directed in other ways, possibly. Now, I don't know all your stories in your lives, but it's something to really get very honest with yourself. If you want to take up a course of study and get to one of Geshe-la's classes, or you want to do this retreat and you want to figure out, and I sometimes look at the year and find, and I'll look in a Buddhist magazine and go, oh, I want to go to that. Where is that? How can I get there? Can I? And you can map out your holidays from work. You know, I was full-time working at Milarepa Center. You know, and I'm kind of full-time working now teaching. So So I will look at it. If it's something that important, I have spent times as a lay person before I was even at a Dharma center. I had a regular job. I had a regular job, right? And I would kind of look at stuff and said, oh, I want to get to that thing. And I was living in California. I went, oh, that's in California. So I can get the ticket to Southern California. I can get my ticket for the event. That's worth it to me. I'm going to make sure I ask for time off. It's up to you for your mind if you want to do it. And I know it takes effort and it changes things, and people in your life say, well, I thought we were going to go on the beach holiday. You know? So find out a way you could do both. But it means that something might have to be sacrificed, that you may not get the girls' outing or the weekend with the guys at the Super Bowl or the... But again, it's totally your decision, but this is about a path that leads you to freedom that makes you happier. So again, are you standing there opening the door of your prison and saying, I really want to get enlightened, but I'm a little bit busy today? You know, now sometimes we are busy. I get that. But can you find a balance where one day you make a little bit more effort and the next day watch your TV show? Right? Find a balance. There's always a thing about a balance. Right? It doesn't mean totally glomming on and getting so grasping into your practice that you obliterate your family. That's not worth it either. That's not healthy. Yeah. I find this to be, so Lam Rim is steps on the path. Steps. It's gradual. So I do meet people, they met the Dharma, they go home and they're like, okay, I heard about karma, I'm leaving you. Their husband, you know, I need to, it's that, right? But that's not skillful. That's not skillful. So you can march along with your family even if they're not Buddhists. I know many people practicing, and my family initially was very worried when I first was writing. I'm at this monastery. My mother was afraid I'm going to shave my head. And really, I had a long mane. Maybe Robbie's the only one who remembers me with hair. Do you remember? Yeah, I had a long mane of hair. I'm not sure if anybody else remembers me. I had a bunch of hair, you know, big hair, as they called it. Right. So, but I went over, I was writing letters, like the late 80s sometime. But so what happens, and then you come back and you sometimes get so excited about what you learned, you try to explain it to people, but you don't have all the information. So they ask you a question about karma, and you're like, I don't really know. And they go, so you're doing that? Well, what's the point of doing that then? You know, yeah, so just take it slowly. So I never talk about Buddhism with people. Even when I was a layperson, until they asked me, because that shows me they're interested. If I start pontificating, let me tell you about the nature of the mind, subtle mind, you know, forget it. People, you just lose them. I don't know what kind of thing she's doing there. Crazy. Okay? So this is your private arrangement, and you go along, and what happens is some of your friends and family might suddenly see that you're a little less reactive, a little more calmer and a little more peaceful and a little sweeter to somebody, and that gets people's attention. And then I had friends saying to me, so what were you doing there in the monastery? You know, what's that retreat you just did? What? Tell me about it. Then they want to hear. That's much more skillful. So you can practice, but you've got to figure out that balance in your life. It's, you know, like we do, executives do it, time management. You know, look at all this stuff, and you have to get honest. You could do, we've done sometimes in longer retreats, a weekly assessment. How much time do you spend watching TV, surfing the internet, on Facebook, YouTube, making food, buying food, driving to work, working, dressing yourself, adorning yourself, having time with the kids, reading, you know, paging through magazines? Really, they assessed, and some people who thought, I really don't surf the internet much, they found out they surf the internet a lot. So there were ways they suddenly went, well, I could take an hour from here, and I can put it over here. And if you can't do an hour, I bet you could find 15 minutes. Okay, so I'm just trying to break it down to make it possible, because I ask you, please, this is what we really need to do. Not just for ourselves, but it's for ourselves, and it's for the planet. We have to subdue some stuff here, but you have to do the internal external. Because if you miss the internal, it doesn't really have that much of an effect on the external. Okay, so let's talk about a little bit more in general antidotes. We again have mindfulness or self-awareness. Number two, remembering the nature of mind. Okay? The mind is clear, non-physical, like that. Mental events, thoughts, and emotions, they come and go like clouds. They are impermanent. Okay? So for those of you suffering from, well, any of the delusions, but I'll also talk specifically about depression and anxiety, okay, it is not permanent, no matter how much you think it is. And so what I ask you to do sometimes in a meditation is, when you're having an anxiety attack, which can be very crippling at times, either in the attack, if it's possible, that can be harder, but sometimes people can do this, or when it's finished, remember that there was a time before it. It's very helpful to keep reminding your mind in depression, chronic depression. There was a time, I know chronically depressed people that remember either moments they're not really feeling that bad, and they also remember a time before the chronic depression really started, and they remember themselves at that time. So partly it helps to chip away that it's not there forever. Has it come into the mind right now and it seems really kind of heavy? Uh-huh. But if there was a time before it, there can be a time after it. So it's important to continually remind yourself of that. And again, leave yourself reminders. Leave little post-it notes for yourself. We have to remind each other. Because there were some of you that went home and probably forgot the exercise last night or this morning. That's okay. All it means is you need reminders. And then you'll get used to it and you start doing it. For me, like to wake up in the morning, it's right there because I just do it every day. So I've got a deep trench now of my motivation and gratitude and... Okay, make sense? Possible? Please try, okay? Okay, I want to talk about in this, remembering the nature of mind helps you to de-identify with the emotion, with the delusion. And these are all techniques. These are all methods, okay? De-identify with the particular emotion, okay? So I know people that would call themselves, I'm an angry person, they might say. I'm a really needy person. I'm a really jealous person. So we layer this whole heavy thing on ourselves. What about, sometimes I have anger in my mind. It's very different, you know? Sometimes I feel really needy, and I really need things, and I'm grasping at stuff. Sometimes I feel that go through my mind. Or whatever's coming up, and I use a lot of humor for myself. If I get annoyed at somebody, you're driving or something, suddenly I'll watch it, and I'll be like, wow. I told you last night, the cement man, we were talking, I had this cement job at my dad's. Hoo-wee! You know, I went in the house one day, and my father was so fed up with the guy. My father's, and he sends me out there. Great. He says, and he goes, what's he doing now? And my father's really prone to anger. That's kind of his, and he's not a Buddhist. And what's he doing now? You know, and he said some very nasty word about the guy. Okay. So then I come in the house, and I'm annoyed with the guy. I can feel that. And then I just watch how it could be this sweeping anger. And I was just like, whoa, look at that little, you know, just surf that wave. Look at that. Goodness. I certainly don't want to respond from there. So it's a little bit play with it. Like, wow, there is this huge piece of confusion in my mind. That's all. It's not always in my mind. Because this morning I woke up and I felt pretty clear. You know? And tonight you might be really peaceful. So it's not always in my mind. That's okay. But right now, goodness gracious. Look at that tidal wave. Sometimes it's like that. Then it gives the emotion less power over you. Okay. So here's number three, general antidote. General antidote. Being non-judgmental. We don't judge, do we? Right? This is a tricky one. Being non-judgmental. You might notice that you tend to like certain thoughts and emotions that come through your mind and dislike others. Okay. And so this can lead you into, I'm no good, I had this negative thought. You know, I had this sweeping irritation in my mind and anger at the cement guy, but I'm the same me before I had that moment. I'm still me. I'm okay. I'm trying alongside everybody else. So why suddenly if I have a little bit of anger come into my mind, or a big degree of anger, am I no good anymore? I'm watching my anger. That's pretty good. For a start, that's great. You see what I mean? De-identify with it. And don't be so judgmental on yourself just because you get angry sometimes, just because you're grasping, just because you got completely confused and have no idea, you know, what you're saying to this person and why you said it, or just because you're feeling arrogant or anxious. So it's not just about judgments out. It's about judgments here. So can you cultivate a sense of equanimity, a non-judgmental, loving awareness and acceptance of whatever arises in your mind? This is our work. This is our practice. Okay? To cultivate a non-judgmental, loving awareness and acceptance of whatever arises in your mind. So I want you to play with that from when you leave here tonight till you come back tomorrow, please. And notice when it's not there. Notice when you've thought about it and now you've interjected it in there. I noticed with the cement guy, at one point I was not being loving with myself. So how was I going to be loving with him? You know, I got angry at myself for getting angry at him. You know, but then I noticed it and I went, all right. Calm down. It's all good here. I'm trying. I'm okay. Just had a bit of anger come in my mind. Took a couple breaths, went out, and then we had a nice little interaction. He was a good piece, though, I'll tell you. He was really pushing the button. I mean, just, it was like all of my, as a kid I lied. I was a liar as a kid. I was so good at it. Right? Some imprint. So then I worked in politics in my 20s. Perfect, right? Go right into segue, right? So obviously there's a lot of lying karma. I looked at this later when I got into the Dharma in my late 20s. Really, I was like, wow, there's just been this area of lying, non-virtuous speech, and then I got kind of condoned for it in my work. Like I was rewarded, and I got things for it. And then I went like, enough. I got into Dharma and I went, I'm stopping that. It took me 2 years of consciously going after every time I'd want to fall into it, right? Really going after it. It really shifted my speech karma, okay? But then the cement man turned up. And I have never listened to so many stories in a one-week period from this guy about lying directly to my face about stuff that they were going to do or not do or that they... I saw them throwing concrete into the woods behind our house to dump it. I witnessed it. And unless my eyesight is really that bad, I saw them throwing. And then they said they didn't throw anything. Okay. And then they said they cleaned it up. I said, okay. And I didn't look. And then I went in the woods and there was this pile of stone that they had not only thrown, but had carefully placed in there as garbage. This huge cement, concrete-like mess of cinder blocks, broken cinder blocks, in a naturally clean wooded area that, you know... So this just kept going on. I was like, this is my speech karma coming back to me. Okay. But it was helpful for me to know that I was purifying something rather than get angry. I created this. That's what karma, I created this. That's another way of subduing the negative tendency. You have to understand karma. Meaning, karma says, I created this scene. I create my reality and what's playing on the movie of my life. Does it mean there's nothing out there? No. And His Holiness the Dalai Lama, this is another debate point. And I've heard His Holiness directly in a teaching say there is something out there that has its own karma from that side. Okay, I've heard other teachers say, no, there isn't. But in any event, I have to take responsibility for my activities of my body, speech, and mind. And all I had to do was attack him back or lie to him, and I'm perpetuating the cycle. This is my belief system. And this is from Tibetan Buddhism. So what I did is I acknowledged and went, wow, he's directly lying to me, is what it appears to me. He did it several times, right? And another guy on the crew did the same thing. And then instead of getting angry, I went, okay, God, I've lied so much. This must just continue to purify the negging, the lying karma. That's what this is. So it just really diffused my whole anger at him of, how can you lie to me? He would say, why are you lying to me? You know, what's that going to do? But so I went, okay, this is uncomfortable. I don't like this. I want him to go away, but That's how I was looking at it, my perception of that. So immediately I could feel more subdued here, not so charged and not so angry and not so I'm going to fix out there. So we have to just keep signing up for that kind of thing. Okay, being non-judgmental. Okay. Because again, I had this little bit non-judgmental, loving kindness, loving awareness, and acceptance. Acceptance, huge word, of whatever arises in my mind. For years I didn't accept that I would get angry. I think poor Robbie had an example of that maybe in 1994, which I apologize profusely for. But what I also feel now is, yeah, sometimes I get angry. I don't intend it, right? Sometimes you feel attached or grasping. Sometimes you feel completely depressed and off base and off balance and completely anxious and, okay? So, but I accept that part of me, but I'm working on it. I don't accept it and just say, well, that's how I am. Sorry. No, I look at that and I work on it every day, whatever my delusion is. Work on it a lot so that that's not what's a familiar path for me. So then I also said the word discomfort. It's uncomfortable, right? First of all, in the face of your delusion and when you're tangling with somebody else because of it. And you can always say it's them. They're doing it to me. It's them. We love that. Okay? So then you don't get to do your work as adequately. Okay? So what I wanted to say is, in accepting, so the spiritual path for me is getting comfortable with the uncomfortable. Life is uncomfortable. Samsara, it's a broken situation. I'm sorry, right? Samsara, Sanskrit word to turn, to cycle. Tibetan word is korwa, K-O-R-W-A. You do korwa around the stupa. You turn, circle. We're turning through birth, old age, sickness, and death. All of that is a problem. So that's the container. So let's accept that for one thing and not be so surprised when life challenges us. That's its container. And for me to have my eyes more open to that, it doesn't mean I don't enjoy. I think I enjoy more now knowing that samsara is suffering. Because it doesn't surprise me. But however, what you can do is glean the good times. There's a lot of joy out there. But I understand it in its context. So if you eat an ice cream cone, enjoy it for what it is, but it's not the source of your ultimate happiness. But that's how we engage with a lot of stuff. The TV show, my relationship, my kids, my, you know, these things. And everything comes to an end. Everything's changing. Like that. So the more I'm in that, I understand the fluidity of it, you can ride along with it. Again, it's a dance, remember? Okay, but I do find that we run, especially Americans, as soon as it's uncomfortable, I'm out of here. Okay, so life is uncomfortable, and this gives you the tools to work with it. So I'm not running from my delusion, I'm not suppressing it, and I'm not giving into it and letting it take over. I'm looking at, wow, this cement guy, this is really challenging. I can't believe somebody works like this, so unprofessional. The job was really sloppy as well. And I'm just trying to have a conversation with him. And it's challenging, and how can I do it in the most harmonious way? You know, and we went along for a while, and it was uncomfortable, and I go in the house, and my dad would get all, what's he saying, huh? You know, just fire him, you know. So, but that's our job as spiritual practitioners, especially on the Mahayana path, is you have to show up again and again with your mind, and you have to have a look at it and kind of say, okay, what is a responsible approach here? Okay. So let me go into non-judgmental as well. I want to talk about your story. What's the story you get going that feeds the judgments? We always get stories going, right? So the community I lived in California, we had very challenging communication at one point. People talking about each other behind their backs, trashing each other, criticizing each other, not respectful speech a lot. And we were also told the center was a quarter of a mile down a dirt gravel road, and we were told that the cause of that, the karmic cause of a dirt gravel road, if it disturbed you, and a lot of our members didn't like it, and a lot of the staff didn't like it, and it ruined your cars, the cause of that was harsh speech. Harsh speech, yelling and criticizing people and cursing at them, and you know, is it gets to be like a bumpy situation, right? So this road, okay. So we heard about this, and our community was 15 people were interested in working with a Buddhist therapy on who is based in narrative therapy. What's your story? And we worked with him over 4 years, meeting like every 6 weeks, 4 to 6 weeks. Anyone who lived on the property, staff came and went. They were welcome to participate with us. And we got really, really good with our speech. And we based it in the Lam Rim, and it was very transformative for people. So you have to look at your story. And your story is, you have an issue at work? Anybody? Have an issue with somebody at work? I see some people are like, okay, right? Very common. Very common. What's your problem at work?
I'm a The girl that I do rounds with, because I'm like a medical type situation, she is so rude. She's so hard to work with. Just a really bad attitude. Just hateful.
Okay, so you're a vet tech. You work with animals, and you've got this very rude person that you're working with, right? Other situations people have? Sorry, let me just take these. I'm going to forget. Other work situations?
Not being considerate of my time or my efforts and communication, very poor communication.
Okay, so we've got a couple rude and sensitive, similar kinds of things. They're not really sensitive to you. What's going on? Okay, so let me just, let's look at the stories. Do you ever get a story going about them? What's your story about these people?
I don't, maybe she doesn't have a good personal life, or that's what I try to think of, or she didn't sleep well.
Okay, that's actually good. That's
maybe she's not in a, I don't know, like she doesn't have someone to talk to, or I try to be compassionate in that way, but when I come home, I like vent out on my husband.
Okay, and what do you say? What do you say when you vent?
She's just so mean, and I'm scared she's mean to the animals, or not like mean, but doesn't have as much compassion with sick ICU patients.
Right.
Well, he hears it all.
Right. And do you ever get into more about her and who she is and stuff like that?
I'm scared to ask.
No, I mean when you vent, when you're venting.
When I'm venting to him?
Yeah. Do you ever get into more about her characteristics and who she is and what she looked like? And
oh, yeah.
Yeah, it goes on and on, right?
He probably knows her better than I do.
And what happens with your, do you ever get into stories?
No, I try not to. I try to always think of what are they going through.
Okay.
It usually has nothing to do with me because they could care less about me.
Okay, interesting. So some nice responses where they start to consider the other person. Thank you. I mean, very helpful. But then you get stories. Yeah.
I was going to say with the negative stories, it's I will give them nicknames to, you know, and then I'll diagnose them with a mental illness.
Of course.
And then I try to get them to up their meds, like ask them what medications they're on and all that.
Okay, so let me tell you one thing here is there is a mental illness called, some of you might know, delusional disorder. Are you familiar with delusional disorder? Is an actual mental illness called that. My brother-in-law died of it, I would say. Delusional disorder. It's supposed to be related to schizophrenia, but it's not schizophrenia. It's treated slightly different with long-term therapy and some medication, depending if you've got anxiety and depression, which often accompany it. And it's very serious illness. And when he was ill for 11 years, and I went to some of the lamas about it, and just a lovely guy, and he ended up committing suicide. But it was really the illness, I think, that really took him down.
So when he was diagnosed, I was living at the center in California, and the staff there knew he had been ill for a while, and we didn't know what was wrong with him, and then he was diagnosed. And so then I said to them, at one point I said, well, delusional disorder, I guess we all kind of have that, right? So don't we all kind of have that on some level? Now, not to the degree that he had it. Fortunately, not to the degree, but we all suffer from some sort of delusion and off balance, and our perspective gets colored by the delusion. So be very cautious of your stories. And one story I'll give you, and a typical example like these, but I think you guys were dealing with it a bit differently. So at the cook at Vajrapani, there was a good friend of mine at the time, a big guy, and he lived next door to me, and one day I come down to the building to work, and I come in the kitchen door, and there he is in the kitchen, and I said, hi, good morning. I'm in my little me, myself, and I bubble, not really thinking about others. And I walk in, and he's across the kitchen, and he very rudely barks something back at me. And so it kind of disarmed me, and I just decided to get out of the kitchen quickly, and I went up to my office and started working in the morning. But he's had some habit of being sarcastic a lot, and it had been difficult for some people in the community. And it came from kind of insecurity and things that he would kind of do these rude things with his speech, and it put people off. And now I'm upstairs working, and it's really irritating me. And what I'm doing is I start creating a story in my head based on this little interaction about him. However, the story, what normally happens, is it turned into an epic drama in my head. Okay, because, and let me explain something, there's something called analytical meditation. We're going to do it in a moment. Analytical meditation. Okay, and what you do is you analyze from every angle. Okay? And you might take, for instance, why it's that we're going to die one day. It's one of the parts of the Lam Rim, that you're definitely going to die. Well, how do you know you're going to die? Well, who's the oldest person I know living? Well, it's interesting. The greatest leaders of the world, they died. They don't have control. The most powerful people on the planet. The greatest composers and most creative people in the world. Einstein died. He was a genius. He couldn't figure it out. People go to the moon, walked on the moon, but they died. Like you literally come from every angle to understand that nobody escapes it. The Pope died, right? Jesus died. The Dalai Lama in the past have died. The Buddha died. So I think I'm immune from this situation. So this is how you analyze. And you analyze with scriptural references. You analyze with life experience. You analyze from teachings you've had, from things you've read in the books, until you have an intellectual understanding that I'm going to die, but now it moves here to an experiential realization. And now I know I'm going to die. Okay, and not to terrify you, but that motivates me to get practicing. This is the only thing you can count on, is that you're going to die. But instead we're planning the vacation, and when I'm going to get my kitchen redone, and you don't know if that's going to happen first or if death comes first. But I've already got the bid in for the kitchen, and I've got my tickets for the trip, but my death stuff, I haven't sorted that at all. Okay? So this is about touching reality, getting real here, okay? So I got this story going because I'm very good at analytical meditation on non-virtuous things. Like, what was wrong with Jim? And he's this, and he's so angry all the time, and he's imposing, and he scares people off, and they're afraid to talk to him, and he's holding the center hostage, and now he's downstairs cooking lunch with that anger for the retreaters, and we have to eat that anger. And yeah, I mean, it was a huge drama. So 2 hours later, a staff person comes to my office. Did you hear what happened to Jim this morning? And all I had to do was hear his name. And I was like, what? Seriously, I was just so blocked from... And then they said that in the morning, he had a health issue, serious health problem with his stomach that he had had a month before that landed him in the hospital. So he was terrified that he was having this attack again, which he wasn't, but he thought he was. Because of that, he had a fight with his partner in their cabin because she said, you're not taking care of yourself, and they had a huge fight. And then we live in a wooded area, and he couldn't find one of his cats, which had gotten eaten sometimes by the coyotes. This is his morning. But he still comes down to cook because it's too late to get a replacement cook, and he has a responsibility, so he's going to cook lunch. So really different experience than what I think. You know, my story's wrong. And now I'm a little bit like, wah, wah, right? So I run downstairs and throw my arms around him and hug him and, can I do something for you? And, you know, and now there's connection because I got my story out of the way. My story that's all caught up and invested in the unhealthy parts of my ego. Okay. So until you've had a direct perception of emptiness, you need to understand that your story is always wrong. I found that really liberating. Because now I can just watch a story get going. Right? But then I can suddenly have this mind that goes, well, that's an interesting story, but not fully accurate. There is a part of your story that has a valid perception to it. From your perspective, it looks like that. But you always have to, one technique continually about countering negative emotions is to continue to poke at yourself. Is that the whole story? Please ask yourself that. When you find the judgments going out, and please ask yourself, is that the whole story? Okay, so brilliant for you guys who are saying, well, I like to consider what's going on for them. I like to think she didn't get enough sleep and she probably doesn't have a partner. And she, you know, like I like to consider, because that's a big part of expanding our mind, is turning it to develop bodhicitta. One of the methods is equalizing and exchanging oneself with others. So first of all, I'm no better than you, you know, and I wonder what your experience is. Okay, so let's do some meditation. Do you want to have it just stand up and stretch? And this is a meditation that, and I should ask you first, what basic delusions are first popping up? What are your main ones you want to deal with?
Fear.
Fear. Anger.
Arrogance,
anxiety.
Hopelessness.
Hopelessness.
Always
comparing yourself with someone?
Personal unworthiness.
Personal unworthiness, okay. That's a lot of what we've been talking about this morning. We have been talking a lot about antidotes for that last night and this morning. Okay, that just gives me an idea that, because this is one that goes after anger, this particular meditation. So let's just sit down, we'll do this, and then we're going to talk about some of these other areas. But I wanted to just do this to get into, because sometimes I find a little bit on the spiritual path, I find usually when I'm in these circles, a lot of us are interested in harmony and harmonizing with the planet and in our families, in our communities, at our workplaces. I think it's really important to bring some peace to the planet. We might not be able to bring peace to the whole world, but we create a pocket here that has some ripple effect out there. You know, and they've actually proven things like that. But so let's just try this. And this is an analytical meditation. Okay, so before you sit and close your eyes, one thing I wanted to mention, again, about analytical meditation. We focused a bit on the breath first, which is what I call placement meditation. Placement meditation, or stabilizing meditation. You're placing your mind on an object, and you're keeping it there. Keeping that builds concentration, and you need that concentration to be able to meditate on emptiness, to penetrate the nature of reality, to realize that. But the other kind of meditation predominantly we do in this tradition is analytical meditation. A lot of people, and we do it on the Lam Rim, and a lot of people say, well, I don't know how to do it. You know, well, you do know how to do it, and we do it really well, just not focused on the right things. So what we do is, and I'll give you an example, if you're obsessed with someone through attraction, if you're angry with someone, don't you kind of, let's say anger for one, you go into like, they're such a jerk, look at his red face, and now he's doing that, and he's so stupid, and he always did this before, just like what I did with Jim. I came from every angle to prove that he was a jerk. And basically to have my anger validated. So when you're attached to someone, attracted and obsessed over them, or an object, you come from every angle about why. Okay, and I'll just bring something to mind right now. Technology. Remember when you were researching your last smartphone? Some people people just get the next one, they don't care. But some people have bought a new one. I've seen people spend weeks researching this one, but that one doesn't do that, but this one does, and then they go to the store again, and then they have to look at it again, and then they have to hold it, and then they want to take it out behind the counter. Can you open it? I want to see this one. And this one has this kind of cover. And this one is, that's analytical meditation. I mean, you're doing it actively, but when you think about the thing later in your mind, you know, for those of you, I'm looking around at the ages, so I don't know if we remember when we fell in love with someone. Do you remember those moments? Okay, but you, my goodness, you came, oh, the eyes were like this, and her hair was, and her body was, and then she said that, and she's, oh, look how she said that. She, you remember how we, this is what analytical, and I love when you see young people, my nephews and niece in their 20s, you know, I love to watch that, because I'm like, so is that falling in love? It's really falling into obsession, isn't it? It's, what's that? Yeah.
And then you get hurt, and then you have a sense of reality for the rest of your life, and you never experience that again.
Right. I mean, you can experience it with everyone if it's pure love. Pure, unconditional love is what? What is it actually? What is love? I'm just curious. It's wanting others to be happy. Others feel it, people feel that it's something else. I'm just curious. Connection, acceptance. Okay, but the essence of pure unconditional love is this, is wanting the other to be happy. Is that how you love people? Right? Sometimes we do. But when you sometimes do, and I ask you to notice a difference, can you feel here when you really love somebody like that? Or do you, when you love somebody but, when you love them if, when you love them when there's conditions on it, you know, and I call that attachment. That kind of love is about me. What am I getting in this? Okay? But the pure love is, I want you to be happy. I want you to be happy. And they feel different. They feel different. Love for children is like that, yeah. Yeah, often it's like that for our kids, yeah. So it's beautiful to get into that, and so you can actually really expand that and feel that for all beings. When you're around His Holiness the Dalai Lama, that's how he is. You know, and sometimes you're disarmed by it. The first time I met Lama Zopa Rinpoche and had a meeting with Rinpoche, a private appointment with Rinpoche, and I stood at the doorway of the room and I was very nervous because I heard he was clairvoyant. I heard he could read your mind. I didn't want him to read all my sick thoughts. But really, I was like, I don't know what this is about, you know, but I got this appointment, and there I was at the doorway. And as soon as I got to the doorway, I just felt this wave of loving kindness. And I'm not any woo-woo person of, you know, I saw the picture and I had tears pouring down my face and the lights went off and, you know. But there, I just felt this incredible goodness for me, like innocent, total wanting my, and it disarmed me because I haven't been around that kind of pure energy before. I'm talking about pure energy that's good. And His Holiness the Dalai Lama has it. I'm sure maybe Pope Francis has it. Mother Teresa probably had it. Jesus probably had it. And there's other beings that aren't any famous spiritual beings that have it. Right? And it's a wonderful feeling. So we can all develop that in ourselves. Doesn't matter who you are and what you, we can all develop that quality in ourselves. It's possible to change the mind. That's what's exciting. So you're never stuck in depression and anxiety and hopelessness and fear for the rest of your life. Okay? But that's an analytical meditation. You come in and they're like this and they're like this, you know, and it's not focused on anything that virtuous. Okay? So let's do this meditation. So let's just sit comfortably, find that comfortable posture. See if there's any place that needs some relaxing in the body. Try to release any tension. Bring your awareness to your breath. And let's just remind ourselves of our motivation this morning. So take a moment to just reestablish that motivation briefly. So bring to mind sometime recently in your life, could be this past week, this past month, a person you're having a particular difficulty with now, and bring that person to mind, placing them in the space in front of you, facing you, and recall the last conflictive moment you had with them. So you had a negative interaction with them, and place yourself in that situation, recalling as clearly as you can for a few minutes what was said and what was done between the both of you. Notice how you feel in your body and mind in this interaction.
So often it's uncomfortable how it feels. And if you're not thrilled with this interaction and would like to change it, as well as counter anger in your mind or frustration or irritation and the pain that can cause. So let's consider the person now across from us. Are we better than them? So let's consider these two fundamental things we have in common. Just think for a moment to yourself, just as I want to be happy and don't want to suffer, he or she wants to be happy and doesn't want to suffer. Say that a couple times to yourself. So we may have different methods to achieve happiness and avoid suffering, but fundamentally, you and this other person want to be happy and you don't want to suffer. Same thing. Number two, you both have Buddha nature. You both have a seed, a potential that can ripen into a fully enlightened being. Now you have a second thing in common with them. And isn't it amazing how much we both want happiness, but often happiness eludes us? And isn't it interesting how much we both don't want to suffer, but often we meet with suffering. We're kind of in the same boat here. So let's consider a little bit more about this person. They could be rude, insufferable. I don't want to be around them, but part of my life is around them. So what am I going to do about it? Okay? Look across at them. Do you know a lot about their life? We might tell ourselves we do, but do we really know what motivates them? And what is their motivation in this particular interaction? What do I think the motivation is? Have I ever considered their motivation before? What would I like to accomplish in this interaction? So if I fuel the fire of anger, get angry back at them, will I accomplish what I want? Will that help the situation?
So take a moment now. Look across at them. Just for a moment, superimpose the face of somebody you really like on them. And just note your reaction. Just observe what's arising in your mind. They're doing the same stuff, but it's somebody you like. So now go back to the person that's there. Put their face back on. And in a somewhat higher level practice, exchanging oneself with others, one method to develop bodhicitta, let's do the exchange. So you don't actually become the other person, that's not possible. But turn the situation around. Imagine yourself in their mind for a moment, and you are looking back at you in this interaction. You're across from you now having this interaction. So return to each of you on the same side. You're yourself. The other person's there across from you. So the last thing is we get to do this interaction over again. Now you get to do it in a new positive way. So they can say and do and act the same way they've always acted. Perhaps. But it's from your side that you're going to forge a new path. So have the interaction again and play it again in a new way. And often these things don't change with just one time. So you can meditate again and again and again in this new way, creating that familiarity in your mind. However, I want you to look over at this person one more time. In Tibetan Buddhism, as trainings in Lojong, in mind transformation or mind training, this is a big expanse of the mind and heart, is we need these challenging people because they show us our mind. They help us to practice much more than all the people that we like. They show us where we have the work to do. So look across at this person with that mindset. You really need this person to get enlightened because they help you practice patience. If you can get so far with it, feel free to thank them genuinely. And perhaps you could even apologize for any part, any role that you might have in this conflict. So please relax and slowly open your eyes. One thing I wanted to address, occasionally what I've come out of these meditations, the rude person you mentioned who seems to be abusive possibly to these animals or not doing the job so skillfully, is it softened my approach with them in a situation like this. And could you find a space from that later to privately take them aside to tell them how it makes you feel? So sometimes it can dissolve something like that where I'm not just afraid of them and this is happening again and again and again, but I can then, and it has to be private, the criticism, and quiet, you know, to explain that every time you do this, it makes me feel, rather than attacking them, you know, I feel like this. There's also, they talk about these and statements, A-N-D, and statements. What happens is when we criticize people, you might come in with something positive, like, well, I'm really glad that you're on with these animals, but. Okay? So instead, if you can say, and, I was wondering if you could be a little bit more gentle when you approach the blah. I'm just giving examples. It doesn't exactly fit in with it, but something like that. So the main thing is, can you have a direct dialogue compassionately, skillfully with the person first? That's the main thing, privately. Because sometimes people are unaware how much it affects other people. And as long as it's not done in public, like where they're embarrassed, but just could I talk with you at some point? Some people it's not going to work. I understand that. So again, it's me diffusing what's going on in my mind. I don't have to get as hooked by it. You know. And then again, in samsara is the acceptance that sometimes we work with people that are quite challenging. And as Holiness will often say, and this is also in the nature of fear and anxiety, ask yourself, is there something I can do about it? And then if there is, compassionately, skillfully, legally, whatever, you take action. On the Bodhisattva path, as a Mahayana, that's what we're kind of required to do. But again, informed by wisdom, compassion, loving kindness, skillful means like that. And if there's nothing you can do about it, you have to just practice letting go. You can also get another job. You could tell their superior. You could start a petition in the office. You know, there are various things that people have done to get rid of people that it's not working. Yes. And I just want to ask in general, the meditation helpful? A little bit gives you some tools in, especially if anger. But again, this is analytical. So this isn't something you do once. But if you're continuing to have a problem with somebody, this is the thing I did with my mom. 3,000 miles away from her. I just, again and again and again, especially if I knew I was going to see her, again and again and again and again. And then maybe the 80th time, suddenly the natural, the role play that I had done, the healthy one, came out. Because I practiced it. Suddenly it was accessible. And there it was. Right? Yes.
Oh, well, I've been wrestling with this since I started studying Buddhism about 9 or 10 months ago. And I find this very helpful. In fact, just now, this is very helpful. I was at a Boy Scout camp last week, so my job was to ensure the boys had a good time, and I had conflicts with a number of people who were obstacles to them having a good time. So this worked very well. But throughout my study of Buddhism, whenever I think about the Tibetan people and what the Chinese have done with them, I keep thinking, well, what good did this do them? They just have to accept what has happened to them, and there's nothing they can do about it. Is that right?
Well, partly, His Holiness the Dalai Lama has encouraged nonviolence. That is the basic Buddhist premise. And he also asked people to remember karma. So that they said they perpetuated a thing on the Chinese centuries before, that those seeds are in the consciousness of these beings. And anytime you're suffering with something, there's something created in your consciousness that creates that to happen to you. That's the teaching on karma. So that's hard for people to understand, but Buddhism says that's a fact, the law of cause and effect. So if you recall that and remember that a bit, you're not going to understand what caused it. Most ordinary people know. But the thing is, for me to perpetuate the violence on someone else, that will, what goes around comes around. That will come back and bite you in the rear again. That's what His Holiness is saying. So there's no point in getting engaged in a violent conflict again, because he says that's what perpetuated the Tibetans losing their country, being exiled, and being slaughtered. Again, not everybody believes that, but that would be part of the belief system. Because the other question I guess I have for people, and I've asked this often, is, so they had been brutalized. It's a genocide. 1.3 million Tibetans have been killed since the 50s. So where does that come from then? How else would you stop it from continuing? I'm just curious. And I ask you, sorry, if you're, what would you suggest they do as an alternative then?
Well, they don't have an alternative. I mean, they could have fought like dogs and it wouldn't have helped fighting a country the size of China. So other than leaving, and many of them have.
Mm-hmm. So I think, again, as Holiness saying, is there something you can do about it? Take action. Again, I would please remember, with compassion, loving kindness, wisdom, okay, that has to inform it. Your motivation has to be a pure motivation. Take action. If not, then you have to practice letting it go and accepting. Because otherwise you're just, you know, tormented. I met one lama in Tibet, and this blew me away. I was not a Buddhist at the time. I had the good fortune to go to Tibet in 1987 when Lama Zopa Rinpoche led a trip of about 60 students. I had just met him and done my first course. But I went ahead of Rinpoche with a couple of monks, Western monks, and we got these private little sessions with some of these great lamas living in Lhasa who had lived in the slaughter of the 50s and the 60s. And one of them, and I was all new to this, I didn't really know anything about Buddhism. So we were in the room, five of us, with this great lama that was there. And he, matter-of-factly, was talking about what the Chinese did to him. But I was all new to this story anyway. So it was a half an hour talk. He was just talking for half an hour.
and I was sick to my stomach, and I was just about to leave the room, and first of all, my mind was just, first of all, sickened and sad, and you wouldn't treat an animal like this, right? But then I started to get enraged. You know, how are these people, like, I just want to kill them. I mean, this was just, how could anybody do this to people? So this, it started to build in my mind. You know, I'm sure he knew the entire thing of what was going on in my mind, this being. I forget his name. He's amazing, right? And he's very matter-of-factly telling a story. You know, and then they bashed me in the side of the head with the gun, and then they smashed my, you know, just like this. And so then I'm getting more and more and more enraged, and I'm just about to leave the room thinking, I can't hear any more of this. Can't hear any more, right? And he stops, and he throws his head back in the most genuine laughter. Seriously there. And then he says, what else can you do but have compassion? Right? Blew me out. He was seriously there in compassion. He wasn't just, you know, this is fun. Love this, right? But what else can you do but have compassion? So it's a very high level of practice, very extremely high level of practice with your serious evil perpetrator, let's say. Okay? So let's say we could head there where you realize that's the undoing of, because these people are going to suffer by doing this to me. Unbelievable torment and suffering. Right? So what a huge space of heart to say, I really feel for this person inflicting this on me. You know? So just gives you the other end of the spectrum of where we can head to. Okay, I found it very inspiring. I mean, it totally shut down my anger and rage at them. It was done. It was gone. I was like, because I could just see it in him of how, like, that's what you have to do is you have to practice compassion. So, in a sense, I sometimes use these words, bodhisattva warrior, that we're trying to be bodhisattva warriors on the Mahayana path. And what that means is the warriors, they don't go to war with other beings. You go to war with your delusions. So every time I notice anger come up in my mind, that's when I'm aiming my dagger out. Every time self-cherishing comes up in my mind, my self-absorption and selfishness. Every time fear and anxiety and depression, that's what we're working on as bodhisattva warriors. You know, throwing darts of compassion at people, you know, that are angry and things. And we do the best we can do. You know, a lot of times we're not that skilled and we're not that tamed, so it's a process. Okay. Any other questions about the meditation? Anything? Did it help to diffuse a little bit some of the situations? Yeah? Anybody not diffused? What happened?
Well, it brought up though.
Because it's hard sometimes. Yeah.
Well, it's a very personal, difficult situation, and it brought it up even more. But to what you talked about, what do you do when you know that it's beyond your skill level and you try to pull yourself out of it, but then you are actively pursued physically by that person?
Okay.
You know, I'm trying to leave, but she's getting in my, opening the car door, so I can't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you see that it's going to keep ratcheting up a notch.
Yep. So there's also, can everybody hear her? Okay. There's also cases of abusive relationships and abuse from childhood. Okay? And people hold on to these things and the abuser, and I'll never forgive them. But what happens is it usually keeps you in prison. So there's a couple things with this. Again, I mentioned toxic situations, toxic people. It's not really that they're toxic, but the situation, there's a lot of people that I meet that choose suffering. You know these people? And sometimes it's us. You know, we continue to head down that street and it's full of potholes, but I'm racing down there. Get me to that first pothole, please, and may I fall into it. We're often down on our knees begging for suffering. Aren't we sometimes? Okay. So it's okay. We're just ordinary. This is a habit. So there are times I've removed myself from a person or situation. You know, but nicely, not in a big anger, I'm not spending any time with you, but just I've declined. There's a couple people in my life close to me that I love dearly, but when they get together,
I'm not very comfortable in the situation. I am disrespected. I'm ignored. They have very unhealthy habits that I don't feel comfortable with at all. It just isn't a kind of situation I'm in anymore. You know, they're not Buddhists, not Dharma people. And so what happens is I sometimes watch a situation getting set up for a get-together, and then I note if everybody falls out and it's just these two people, I find a way to decline. A nice way. Oh, I'm really sorry, I'm busy, I can't make it. Because I know I'm not safe in that environment. Meaning that all the work I've done on myself, it's going to bring me down somehow. It's going to start accessing some unhealthy patterns I've had in the past. And so this is about when I mentioned knowing your coping mechanisms and your triggers before lunch, that's a trigger for me. So my skillful means is noting, being aware of the trigger, noting my mind, and I'm like, oh, there's that situation again, and I'm just going to choose not to be part of that right now because it's not that healthy for them or for me. So I don't know if that's a situation where you can sometimes get yourself out of that before it happens. Is that possible?
Sometimes yes and sometimes no.
Okay.
It's daily life with this person.
Right. So
part of the way that it is.
So part of the daily life with somebody, and I don't know the specific situation, but I do know people in domestic abuse issues, and you have to wake up and get yourself out of the relationship, sorry, or get some help. Whether there's an intervention with the person that's abusive or dangerous or whatever, alcoholic, whatever it is, mentally ill, it could be anything. But I would not advocate perpetuating something if it's really making you suffer. And you feel like you're somewhat woken up to, like, this is really, really unhealthy. It doesn't mean you never have to talk to them again or be in, but sometimes interventions have helped, where I've seen the family members came together and it finally said, we've had enough, we're sorry, this is not working anymore. That's also the beginning of your renunciation. I can't do this anymore like this. I'm sick enough of it. In fact, sometimes you're sick because of it. I had an issue in relationships. I didn't do them very well. And as intimate relationships before I was a nun. And then what I kept doing was perpetuating these things that me and the other person were doing really negative, destructive things to each other and together and whatever. You know? And then something kind of happened with this other person and there was this real kind of big blowout. And I really got sick to my stomach where I realized, and I just remember saying mentally to myself, I'm not doing this anymore. Like sometimes you have to make that resolution in your mind, I am not going here anymore. I'm not doing this anymore. Right. So I backed out of it, and then I limited the time I would see them. And then the next time I saw them, I very, in a very public place, made this very quiet thing to them that I wouldn't be able to continue in the way we were continuing. I tried to keep it really simple too. I just couldn't continue like that. I really cared about them. I really wanted to do this, but I can't go on. It wasn't that we can't. I was taking responsibility. I am not going to go on like this anymore. I'm sorry. I'm not available for that. So do you want to continue with me? Do you want to figure it out? But I can't do this anymore. And it was a really big break for me in relationship. I never did it like that again. You know. So again, that's as much as you can do. There are people that aren't going to get out of it, and then they just continue. But I think to develop some of our own self-respect, you know, I think it's powerful. But it's hard. I know it's not easy. Not easy. I don't know if that's helpful.
Sure.
But you try. Just try your best, right? Slowly. Maybe get some support around you of other people, too, that can help you. You know, that's why for domestic abuse people, there are shelters that women can call and go to. It's not just women who are abused. Men are also abused. But where people can call and go and they get more resources and support. There's people I know that had to get out of the house with their kids. And where are you going to live? They don't have any money. They didn't have another rental. They couldn't. There wasn't family. So there are places. Sometimes we do have family and friends that have been wanting us to get out of it. So, again, find your resources if you have them. And if not, there's other places you can call often to help support you like that. Some people have done it with a natural holiday. They take a separate holiday to make some kind of break of a week where they're like, okay, you know, when I come back, I've got to, you know, people have done it with cigarette smoking. People have done it with diets. I'm going on a juice fast next week, and that'll help me. You know, there's different ways we can try to skillfully. Anybody else? Okay. Let's look at fear Okay. Fear is a big one for people. It underlies a lot of things. A lot of things about fear. Fear creates other issues, other delusions. And there's something underneath fear. Anybody? No. So what are the kind of things we fear? I'm just curious. Snakes. Okay. Snakes.
Spiders.
Spiders. Poisonous animals that can kill us, let's say. Let's think about a spider. Who's afraid of spiders here? Okay? So I used to be afraid of spiders. You know, I watched too many giant tarantulas in New York City movies, okay? Oh, my God. When the big legs would come over the hill, you know, I'd be like, ah! Okay. But look at spiders. Most spiders, compared to our size, oh, my goodness. We are huge. We're huge. I mean, one of the biggest spiders I've seen this big. Well, look at me. You think that thing isn't afraid of us? And you see when you come in a room and it's like, whoa, it takes off. You turn, you know, like, whoa. Okay? So one thing is to put it in perspective. Like, can you be the spider for a minute? What's their life like? Right. Spiders eat a lot of insects and things that bite us. So sometimes they have their things. But what else are you afraid of? So we've got the stingy animals, the killing animals.
Failure.
Failure. Oh, yes. What are you afraid of? You mentioned fear.
Mistakes.
Mistakes and failure. That we're going to screw up.
Unknown.
Death. Oh, yes. Death's a big one. What else are you afraid of?
Loss.
Humiliation.
Change.
Change. I'm afraid of dying for a long, long time in a lot of pain. That's a fear I have. In uncontrolled pain, like that. So let's look at fear, okay? The things that we fear, the things we're afraid of, what can you do about them? What can we actually do about them, some of them? So there's something underneath fear. Anybody?
Courageous.
The unknown? The?
Be courageous.
It is a C word, but it's a different C word.
Control.
Death and change, thank you. Control. Okay? We're afraid that we're going to lose control. And what can you control?
Yourself.
Yourself, your mind. Thank you. Not nothing. Your mind is the only thing you can control. Your attitude. Your mind, yourself. That's it. It's easier to know that. Fundamentally, instead of blooding your head against the wall trying to change everything else. Master Shanti Davis' famous quote. Okay? Your choice, if you want the ground to be soft for you to walk on, is cover the entire planet with a soft material. He says leather in the quote. Or you can just put it on your own feet. So get your mind together. If you want it to be together out there. So we all have this terrible fear of losing control, or that we don't have control and we need to have control. Some of us more than others. I come from a family of control freaks. And I like to think I'm in recovery, but I'm not sure always that I am, but I try. Okay? So, when you really look at it, we can't always control the environments as far as animals and things like that, but most of our houses that are sealed and locked, you don't have snakes necessarily coming in all over the place, and you may choose not to go to a place that has a lot of wild insects and animals like that. You can control that. Mm-hmm. That's something you can monitor like that. Again, that's a skillful thing within reason. Okay. What about failure and mistakes? Okay. So here's the acceptance of being a human. That means I'm going to fail and I'm going to make mistakes. Can you learn to accept that? Can you start to introduce yourself to a habit where I can accept that sometimes I'm going to blow it? And the reason is, it's a given. That's its nature. Okay, that's its nature. Is that the human condition is flawed and we will make mistakes. So the more you can come in contact with that, and this is analytically... Again, you realize it's not reasonable to be afraid of failing or making mistakes. The nature of samsara, again, is that we'll make mistakes. So if you are in a swimming pool filled with water, okay, and you're in the middle of the swimming pool, you don't flail around and go, ah, it's wet in here. That's its nature. That's its nature. The nature of water is it's moist. Okay, so the nature of samsara is that you're going to fail and make mistakes. So the more you face up to that and realize that, and that's one of the antidotes to fear. Face up to your fear. Is it realistic to have this fear? Okay. Right. Okay. And what can you do about it then? No, you can't. But what you can do is learn from there, so you don't make the same mistakes, right?
I make them over and over.
Okay. So that's something that I would then wake up to say, why do I continue to make them? That's using your wisdom. What's that?
Better
mess. Right. But maybe you do. Maybe you do. You know. Right, or to look at why you're taking the meds, because you can get off of certain meds. But what I'm saying is, seriously, part of this path, Bodhisattva warrior path, is it insists on you using compassion and wisdom and loving kindness, developing those within yourself. You have those qualities. Okay, but you can develop those, right? It's possible. It's possible, yeah, right? Possible. Okay, fantastic. So it is possible. Is it going to take effort? Yeah, sure. Okay, but it is possible to do that. You know, I made a lot of mistakes, the same time falling flat on my face, and then sometimes finally I got it. You know, and then I'd make a little bit like that mistake, but a little lesser. So I was like, okay, making some progress here. Changing the mind, Lama Yeshe said, it's not like painting a room. It doesn't happen in 4 hours. I'm sorry. I wish it did, but it doesn't. So that's the thing is, look at that, of like, what happened? I kept doing it again. Well, I've got to look at that. My pattern in relationship, I did it again and again, and then I got sick of it. Let's hope you get sick of your delusion before you bottom out and die from it. Seriously, people with mental illness, and let's say alcoholism. Sometimes I've worked with a lot of alcoholics, okay? Substance abusers. The ones that get into recovery and do well usually use many components. So they've got the 12-step group, they've got meditation, they've got a therapist, they've got their sponsor. Several things they say work the best for the longest term. Those using one method, often they relapse. Okay? But what they've also said is the ones that did really well, they bottomed out before they died. So they hit rock bottom and they said, enough. I can't do this anymore. It's a very powerful place, that dark night of the soul. It's not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing to have a breakdown. Because what it means is the system, the way it's going, is simply not working. That's why it's breaking down. Okay, so it's a different way to look at breakdown. We sometimes see it as negative in our culture. I sometimes have seen it in people. It's brilliant. System not working, it broke. So the best ones are the ones that get to put the pieces back together in a new way. That's exciting. It doesn't mean they're going to put all of them back in the right way, but they really are like, okay, no, that was a mistake. I made that, so I'm not taking that piece. I'm going to reconstruct this in a different way. I want to bring up one thing. There was a TED Talk, but I read the book. There is a neuroanatomist, a neuroscientist named Jill Bolt Taylor. Jill Bolt Taylor. She had a stroke at the age of 37, and she wrote a book about it, about her stroke and recovery. It took 7 years for her to recover. The book is called My Stroke of Insight. My Stroke of Insight. I highly recommend it. But there's a TED Talk of her talking about this. And what I loved in the book is she says that she's a neuroanatomist. She knows how the brain works, how the neurological activity works. And she says that when a thought kind of process comes in, especially when you get delusion going, some negative sweep comes through. You can label it anything. She says technically the neurological activity from the formation of that process until it sweeps through the body and leaves is 90 seconds. 90 seconds. A minute and a half. So I found that really exciting because what happens is if I get my little, I got my cement guy there and here it comes, right? Here comes anger. Or here comes fear. Right? Here comes anxiety. I'm sinking into depression right now. I'm so attached to this. I'm watching attachment come through, whether it's a person or I see the latest thing I need to buy. I'm got to have that thing, is I now allow myself the 90 seconds. I just give myself over to the delusion for 90 seconds, though, only. You know, I don't react, and that's it. I just watch my mind. Who can't watch their mind for a minute and a half and be like, whoa, I'm angry. Here comes anger. Here comes fear. 90 seconds. And then I let it go. Okay. And I really practice the letting go and moving on. Why? Because I know it's done in my system. Okay. What happens is habit and familiarity allows you to carry it on. And you loop it over and over. And you start analytically, I'm afraid, I'm going to make a mistake, I'm going to do that stupid thing again, I'm stupid, I'm no good, I just do everything wrong. And that's just a habit from the delusion. But that's not what has to continue. It's in there because you have previous moments of doing that looping. Guilty, 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 I need to do this, they're going to think I'm lousy. Okay, so the practice is sometimes, I call it thought interruption. First of all, I gave you yesterday, Trungpa Rinpoche, it's simply thinking. Just label it. Thinking. You know? I watch the guilt go on, I watch the fear go on. It's simply thinking. Let it go. Watch the cloud burst the bubble. Gone. Okay. And then thought interruption. I've actually said, and I've worked with some people in, stop thinking. Stop thinking. That's harder for some people, but some people can get that. Stop thinking. The third thing is thought replacement. Thought replacement. Okay? Whatever image conjures up something happy, warm for you, playful, delightful, laughter, put that in place of the anger, attachment, confusion, jealousy, pride, anxiety, depression, fear, worry, failure, you know. Whatever image. That, I know one woman, for her thing is puppy dogs. Somebody else's bubble. Somebody else is riding a roller coaster. Somebody else, whatever your thing, it could be one word that you pop in, daisy, or light, or, but make it your own thing. You might have a few words and images. You know, and your exercises, I have to go there when I start this looping. You'll start creating different pathways. You could think of the Dalai Lama. He lost his country, for God's sake. Yeah? We have passports from our country. You're not all Americans here. We have passports. We can stay in this country if you're a U.S. citizen as long as you like, and you don't need a visa. Nobody's going to check. Are you legal here? No. He doesn't have that luxury. Nor do any of the Tibetan refugees that came out with him. They have these ridiculous Indian identity certificates, that these booklets that aren't really passports. They can get visas and go places, but it's a hassle. Because I traveled with two Tibetans that we went around the world. It was really difficult. Okay? So you can think of other people so much less fortunate than you, you know, and try to a little bit bring that in. Okay? This does take effort to exercise your mind that way. But these are many, many different techniques. Okay? So one other thing I wanted to mention in the anger meditation, when you put your friend's face on there, this is about, I want to say these two words, forgiveness and acceptance. Forgiveness and acceptance. This is hard. Forgiveness and acceptance. And I'll even say acceptance and forgiveness. Put it in alphabetical order. Acceptance. I make mistakes. I don't know. Sometimes I don't know. I have no idea. Don't have all the information. I simply don't, because I'm a human being. But because I'm a human being, I have a potential that can awaken into a Buddha. And I'm doing everything I can do to get there, okay? And you know what? Sometimes I'm lazy. Sometimes I want to watch a TV show. Right? And you know what? I accept that about myself. You know? And if I get really, really lazy and I really mess up and I fail again and I blew it, you know, I can forgive myself. Right? Because I'm again showing up with my mind. I'm going to try. I get another day and I'm going to try another day. Some days, more cooperative my mind. Some days, not at all. And this is me and my mind. You see what I mean? Do you see how it goes? It's a gentle process. It's not me ramming myself. I'm not squeezing and grinding, and I have to be like this. I have to be perfect. And it's got to be, because life isn't like that. I used to be like that. I was miserable. Seriously. And I made everybody around me miserable. So now it's kind of fun. I mean, it's like, you know, it's not that things go well. I mean, Cement Man and me, it wasn't always great with us. Trust me, I fell a few times. I really was like, I went back in the house and it was like, you know, God, I am like useless here, you know. Okay, but I didn't really stay on that very long. It was just like, all right, we're going to do better next time. Okay, it happens. Yes.
Do people stay in their prison because they don't want to make the effort? It's easier to be miserable, or that they don't think it's possible to be happy?
I think it's both. What you say? What do you? I think it's both. You know, it takes a lot of effort, and it seems sometimes easier to turn the TV on and veg out. And that's a habit a lot of people have. I'm just using that as an example. And then I think some people just prefer to choose the suffering. And then a lot of people don't understand that there's a healthy way of being. They haven't had familiarity and experience with that, so they don't believe it exists. But it exists. It's available to everyone, everybody on the planet, everybody in this room. It's available. And haven't you found that some of the greatest challenges in your life, when you got through them, weren't they the most worthwhile? Personally, I found that myself. You know, it doesn't mean it's all going to be a bowl of cherries. It's just not. But once I got past, you know, even the really darkest moments, when I got through them, there was light there on the other side, sometimes more brilliant than before, because I cleared away something in the middle. So I'd say it's a bit of a combination of things. So let's go back to the fear and the worry and the anxiety, which is, so again, look at the control issues when you're trying to control what's out there, how it keeps you imprisoned in certain things, meaning that miserable little space here. This is small. Letting go control, this is spacious and okay. Are you a rigid person, or are you a little bit more... You try to exert control over other people? Does it everything have to be your way? It's interesting, right? Oprah Winfrey did a little exercise. I didn't see this program, but somebody told me about it. It would have been interesting to see. She did a thing. She sells tickets to the show, or they give out tickets, whatever. There's tickets. There's so many tickets. It's limited. So what she did as an experiment about stress and anxiety was they got people that arrived at the show, and they asked for permission to film them. And then what they did is they said, we're really sorry, but your tickets today, you and your friend, we oversold the show. So you can't come today, but we've got tickets for you tomorrow, and we have a special present for you. And they had all these nice presents you can have, but we're really, really sorry, but we can't honor your tickets today. And then they filmed people's responses. What would your response be? And how happy would that make you? Presents? Okay, we've got two people who like presents. Happy. Happy. Okay, no car, nothing that big, but, you know, something, you know. How would you respond? Okay, we've got some happy people here, right?
If you only had one day, you'd be angry.
Okay. Okay, that's one response. If I only had one day, I'd be angry. If I had another day, okay, they film people. Two women came up. Can't honor your tickets, we got this. They looked at each other and they said, wow, well, we live in L.A., we can't come tomorrow, but I guess we're going to go to the museum then that we wanted to do, and we couldn't do both, so we'll do that. Thanks very much. Happily went off down the street, no stress. Just, oh well, right? Another person from Chicago couldn't honor it tomorrow, that she could come another day. They said you can come any other day you want to come. It can't be tomorrow, we'll get you tickets for another day. Went ballistic, went absolutely apoplectic. Talk about your stress level, okay? She could come another time and just totally lost it and went off on them.
You know, a lot of it depends on how much you have vested in seeing it over show, too.
But the thing is, you can make any kind of thing, but it's your stress level dealing with it. So you're really invested in this show. It's not happening today. Do you need to upset yourself like that?
No,
Is it worth upsetting yourself so much like that? So I'm talking about all of these interactions you have. Those of you that somebody said fear of not having control. Right? So that's the thing is, I can only control my mind. I can't control tickets to the thing. I can't control when the plane leaves. I can't control that I won't have a cold next week when I have to do the big presentation. I can't control what my kid's going to grow up and be and where they're going to live and that they're going to be healthy. You can't control any of that. I'm sorry. Even if you raise them with every perfect thing, and I can't control who my boss is going to be except when I interview, and if I meet them and I'm terrified, I'm not taking the job. You can control that. That's your mind making a decision. Or you can say, I'm going to take this job with this difficult boss, and that will be my practice. It's really your decision, is what I'm saying. You're empowered to do this and to make these decisions. And I do know, and there's a famous story of Master Atish, I think, but also a contemporary Geshe I know who's since passed away. He had, in America, a very challenging attendant. Nobody liked the attendant. Okay? And people were always like, get rid of him! Okay, everybody hates him. He's horrible to deal with. And the Lama's like, he's perfect for me. You know, really helps me practice patience. So think about it. But there's a level where sometimes so my teacher, some of your teachers, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, his name, Zopa, means patience, by the way. Patience. It's a great teacher for me because I have none. Okay? Patience. Okay? So what he'll say is the antidote to anger, and anger in Tibetan is actually not anger, but patience in Tibetan. It's not really patience etymologically. It's actually bearing up under harsh circumstances. Bearing up under adverse circumstances. Yeah, right? It's not just kind of waiting in line at the doctor and, you know, in your comfortable chair with your People magazine, okay? It's something negative is happening. So we were at a retreat we hosted at the center in California in 1997, and we were a little bit late. Rinpoche was late to give this initiation to start the retreat. And there were 80 people there and a lot of old students. And the first couple of days we were all there without Rinpoche, and it was like a picnic. We were hanging out and telling stories and catching up with each other. And then Rinpoche showed up, got on the throne, and seemed to be very stern. And then he said, this is retreat. This is no picnic. Like, he seemed to be really kind of wrathful with us, and everybody got kind of, And then he said, retreat is about retreating from delusion, which is really what retreat, people say, what do you do on retreat? Well, you do meditation sessions, you can structure it however you want, you can do study retreats, you can do some reading and study. Some people do yoga, but you have your meditation sessions. It could be a certain practice. There's a whole variety of ways to do retreat. Okay? But the main thing is, when a delusion appears in my mind, I need to be able to deal with it. And in retreat, because you're quieter, and sometimes you might go away from all the distractions, and I get a little bit more opportunity to deal with that delusion when it comes up, and apply the antidotes and practice in that setting. That's why it's key to do some retreat every year, even if it's a weekend or something like that. Okay? So then what the next thing Rinpoche said is, he said, you know, this is not a picnic. What I'm most interested in my disciples is how they bear hardship. So it's something to think about in our part of the world where we have a lot of comforts. We have a lot of physical comforts. And what I've noticed from spending time and living in undeveloped countries and living in the States is we have every creature comfort here. We have pretty easy physical lives, but we have so much mental anguish. And when I hang out with some poor people in India and poor people in Nepal, and they have nothing, unbelievably nothing, right? And, you know, mentally, they're okay. They're kind of like, it's amazing. So it's something to think about in our comfort. What happens when a little thorn comes in? How do you want to deal with it? How's your mind? Because it's a great practice. Pema Chodron, the American nun, she's amazing. She's written amazing books. I highly recommend her books. I just saw her last month at this conference. Well, she wasn't at the conference, but I bumped into her before. I've met her a few times.
So she says, you know, practice is leaning into the sharp edges. Okay, so let's get wise and skillful about that, showing up as a bodhisattva warrior, that we don't shy away from that. I kind of go, this is uncomfortable, so now what do I want to do with it? And can I please develop my compassion, wisdom, and loving kindness so I have more skills to deal with this stuff? Because it's always going to be showing up there. And one day, you're going to get finished with it. Okay, and one day your mind will be perfect and omniscient and free of all fears. That's a Buddha mind. And then I'll really be able to show other people how to get there. But it's possible, but it means me a little bit doing the dance where some days it's too much and I have to back off a little from the pain and the things. That's fine. That's your wisdom. This is too much. And then other days, okay, I'm ready to, this is hard being with this person. I'm going to tackle it now. We're going to go in there in a good way. Do you see what I mean? It's possible to do. But acceptance and forgiveness is a big part. Accepting my limitations, setting boundaries, right? Accepting I can't do this, this is as good as I can get. Being honest when I speak to people. Can I explain to somebody I'm having a really hard time now? Maybe somebody at work having a really hard time right now. Or, you know, when you act like that, it makes me really afraid for the animals. Or it makes me really, it really upsets me. I get really kind of scared that this is going to happen. Or I get really intimidated by you. Or I really want to run and hide. You know, whatever the thing is. So being very real and genuine with and gentle, you know, and then accepting my certain situation. And then I have to accept where others are coming from. So if I accept myself, then I can better accept that you're also limited. Yeah. Or actually, I don't know your mind. Maybe you're not limited. Maybe you're a Buddha. I don't know. So why not treat everybody? Like, and I love, like, Neem Karoli Baba, this great, incredible Hindu saint, unbelievably passed away, but he was like, see God in everything. Right? That's nice. Why not? Okay. And then the forgiveness comes from that, is can I forgive myself? I made the mistake again and again and again. Can I give some space to myself that, you know, and then you're much better able to forgive others. Oh, we're out of time. They didn't give me a thing. N330. Didn't get that card. Oh, here it is. Oh, no. Not really. Oh, here we go. Okay. Oh, any last question? Yes.
I'm sitting across from this really difficult person, and I'm wondering, is this person making me miserable, or is this person a gift that shows me what my work is? And I'm anguishing over what's the right thing to do. And what I thought I heard you say was, that's my choice.
That's your choice? To be in front of this person?
Or not?
Well, basically, karma's putting you in front of the person, so that's not necessarily a choice. That's something dictated from the activities you did with your body, speech, and mind in the past. This life, or Buddhism would say, could be past lives.
Right, but there's nothing stopping me from getting up and walking away.
Well, that's a choice you have from there on, is how now do I want to handle it? And I'd like to handle it so I don't have to revisit the discomfort with this person, so I want to be as skillful as possible. But in that place, there's always choices. You know, I have a choice. I can yell back at them and tell them what a crappy person they are, or I can find a bigger space of mind to really try to work out something harmonious with them. Does that make sense? Okay. So let's finish there. And I'd like to dedicate the merit, and I'd like to turn to page 235 in the Gold Prayer Book. These are some basic, these three verses we're going to read, basic dedication prayers. But what I'd like to do is to dedicate that any positive energy that we have taken, that we've created today, can we invest it
in our being able to really counter the delusions and things like that, more and more in our practice, and build a fantastic practice from this that will help us move along this path to full awakening, so we can be of the most benefit to all others. And I'd like to dedicate to the long lives of our teachers, and for those who are ill on the planet to be healed instantly and to have some sort of respite from their disease and their pain, and for conflicts in the world to be pacified. Let's read these in English. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha, lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish, but increase more and more. Just as the brave Manjushri and Samantabhadra too realize things as they are, I too dedicate all these merits in the best way that I may follow their perfect example. So what I, how many people coming back tomorrow? I'm just curious. Okay, so should we do a photo tomorrow? Is that better?
We can do either one. It depends on what you'd like.
What somebody that is helping with my website, she just kept saying, can you get a photo with people that you're teaching? So I wanted to ask if you're okay to be on a public website. Do we want to just do a quick photo now? We could do that. Okay, people are saying, yeah, let's do it now. And what I wanted to ask you, please, for your homework, you've got the meditation things, well, everything we did last night, when you go to sleep, if you do Vajrasattva practice, great, but the little reflection about how the day went. When you wake up in the morning, gratitude, set a motivation, a little bit sitting. And then also check out some of the antidotes we talked about today. How's that working? What are, first of all, getting to know your delusion. What are your coping mechanisms? That's what I want to talk about tomorrow. And then what are the trigger points? So we're going to go a little bit more into some other specific delusions that you mentioned tomorrow. Okay. And looking a little bit at, does somebody hook you the rest of the day? Where do you fall down the rest of the day? I hope you don't, but let's say you do. I'd love to hear about that tomorrow. And were you able to bring something in from today? What's working, what's not working? Okay? Thank you.